when the 23 principal elements were set in action by the will of the Supreme, the gigantic universal form or the Vishwarupa body of the Lord came into existence. Translation of this purport. The Virata Rupa or Vishwarupa, the gigantic universal form of the Lord, which is very much appreciated by the impersonalists, is not an eternal form of the Lord. It is manifested by the Supreme Will of the Lord after the ingredients of the material creation. Lord Krishna exhibited this Virat or Vishwarupa to Arjuna to convince the impersonalists that he is the original personality of Godhead. Krishna exhibited the Virata Rupa. It is not that Krishna was exhibited the Virata Rupa. The Virata Rupa is not, therefore, an eternal form of the Lord exhibited in the spiritual sky. It is a material manifestation of the Lord. The Archa Vigraha, the worshipable deity in the temple, is a similar manifestation of God for the new deity. But in spite of their material touch, such forms of the Lord as the Virata and Archa are all non-different from his eternal form as Lord Krishna. That's in the translation for Krishna.
The 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita is popular, is considered the very important by the impersonalists who presume that the Supreme has no particular form, and any form may represent the Supreme, because within that chapter there's a description of the various forms that appear within the universal form. So they like to say that all gods are the same, and Krishna's, this is proof that Krishna is just a manifestation of various gods, which you can choose anyone you like and worship them, and it's all the same, and we're all the same, and ultimately it's all illusory anyway, is what they say. The idea that Krishna is simply a manifestation of the ultimate impersonal and all forms are a manifestation of the ultimate impersonal is addressed by Lord Krishna himself in Bhagavad Gita, in which he states that those who say that my personality has manifested from the unmanifest, such persons are unintelligent. Who knows that verse? Can anyone say? Anyone? Avyaktam vyaktim. Anyone now? Say it loudly. Manyante mam abuddhayaha. Param bhava majananto mamaishwaram anuttamam. Avyaktam, from the unmanifested. Vyaktim, my personality. Apanam, has come. Manyante, they think, mam, about me, abuddhayaha. Persons, it literally means without any intelligence. Now this is very interesting, because often we think that Shankaracharya invented the Advaita Vedanta, as it's called. Actually, Vedanta means Vedaishtasavarahameva Vedyaha. Vedanta Krit Veda Vedaya Vacharaham. Vedanta, or the conclusion of knowledge, means to understand Krishna. But they have a term, or within philosophy, we have terms Advaita Vedanta, Dvaita Vedanta. But Vedanta, another, or a synonym of this, is Siddhanta. which means the conclusion. So if we say that Vedanta can be either Advaita Vedanta or Dvaita Vedanta, it's not really Vedanta, it's not the conclusion of knowledge if there's a difference of opinion about it. That is why the search has to be for the Param Satya, what is the ultimate truth. It's not simply a matter of philosophical argument or taking sides. There are various words, Mayavad. There are various Vadas, Karmavada. Vada simply means it is said thus. Certain people say this. But there's a difference between a Vada or a theory and Siddhanta. Siddhanta means the actual conclusion. But these words are misused. Siddhanta, Vedanta, they're taken... Although they mean, they refer to an ultimate principle, they're taken to be simply some theory or some dogma that certain people are attached to. Shankaracharya has propounded what is known as Advaitavad or Advaita Vedanta. But he didn't invent it. That contamination of denying the supremacy of Krishna's personality and considering that everything, including Krishna's personality, has come from an unmanifest absolute, that this was prevenient to Shankaracharya is clear from Lord Krishna stating in Bhagavad Gita, avyaktim vyaktim apanam manyante mama buddhayaha. Was already, that misunderstanding was already there. It's always there. It's just that Shankaracharya, he gave a philosophical, or actually an aphilosophical construct to try to support it. But it, because the construct is actually aphilosophical, well, it's pseudo-philosophical. Or quasi-philosophical. It doesn't really support it. The foundation has serious flaws. You may construct a big building, but if the foundation is flawed, then it's not going to stand. So similarly, the Mayavad of Shankaracharya has some basic flaws. I mean, this has been discussed in great detail particularly by the Vaishnava Acharyas. Shankaracharya says, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya. Brahma is reality and this world is false. And everything, they declare that the ultimate Brahma has no name, no form, no qualities, no activities. But their whole philosophy is based on negation. If there were no... It's a logical impossibility. If there were no name, form, qualities or activities, then you couldn't say that there were no name, form, qualities or activities. You follow what I'm saying? If it didn't exist, then you couldn't say it didn't exist. If there was absolutely no substance to name, form, qualities and activities, then you wouldn't have to negate them. If they didn't exist, you wouldn't have to say they didn't exist. Just like the Svatopotamus. You've all heard of the Svatopotamus? You know what the, does anyone know what the spatophotamus is? No one knows what a spatophotamus is. Well, there is no such thing, as far as I know, because I just made up the term. So there's no need to make a philosophy that there's no such thing as a spatophotamus, because it doesn't exist. I can attempt to describe it to you, I can make up something, but it doesn't exist. So there's no need to make a big philosophy denying the existence of spatophotamuses. So similarly, if reality is devoid of name, form, qualities and activities, there's no need to make a big philosophy denying it. The very fact that Shankaracharya, or before him, so many impersonalists also, deny the existence of name, form, qualities and pastimes as illusory, but that in a negative way, it just underlines that they do exist. Now, it's true that names, forms, qualities and pastimes and their interactions in material existence are the cause of suffering. That's true. Lord Buddha famously declared that desire is the cause of all suffering, and therefore we should try to stop all desire. But if you want to stop all desire, well, that's also a desire. So you're stuck. That's why in this Zen Buddhism, Zen is a term which is derived from the Sanskrit dhyana. So they have what are called koans. These are very popular among the neo-Buddhists of the Western world. Zen Buddhist koans. And a koan means like an impossible statement that you're supposed to meditate on. The most famous one is that you have to meditate on the sound of one hand clapping. So, the sound of one hand clapping. So it's impossible, isn't it? It's nonsense, actually. So, they bring out all these absurdities, and you're supposed to meditate upon it, and then you become self-realized, something like that. So the first proposition of Lord Buddha, it is an impossible proposition that one should be free of desire. But then he says that one, namely yourself, you don't exist anyway. So who or what becomes free from desire when desire doesn't exist and the person who's desiring doesn't exist and the objects that he desires, they also don't exist because he says that everything is nothing. Or rather that there is no everything. There is nothing. But there's so many big books of philosophy have been written to discuss how there is nothing. Big books, big libraries, saying how everything is nothing. And even the Buddhists, they argue among themselves over the nature of nothingness. No, everything's nothing like this. No, it's nothing like that. Or nothingness is like this. Nothing, no, nothingness is something else. Well, if it's nothing, there's nothing to discuss. So, although it sounds philosophical, it's absolutely flawed from the very beginning. And although Shankaracharya has attempted to point toward the spiritual, he has in fact just negated the material. To say that desire is the cause of suffering is true within our experience. But that desire is intrinsic to the living being who desires to be happy, suggests that there is a state of existence in which desire actually causes happiness. And that within material existence, within everything that we can observe, everything simply leads to suffering, doesn't mean that there cannot be a state of existence in which desire leads to happiness. It produces actual happiness. Srila Prabhupada often used to use the term a poor fund of knowledge. He used this to refer to all kinds of ignorant people, including Mayavadis, who, because they don't know of the positive spiritual existence of Krishna, propound spiritual reality as being devoid of names, forms, qualities, and activities. And actually that is described in Shastra. Anama, Arupa, no name, no form. But then again in Shastra it's described that the Lord has Sahasranama, Sahasrashirsha. He has many thousands of names and heads and forms. So it appears to be a contradiction. In Advaita Vedanta, they say that the description of the many names and forms of the Supreme is unimportant, because the real important description is that of him having no name or forms. And in Dvaita Vedanta, they say the description of where it says neither, no name, no form, that's the Abheda Vakya. That is not very important. And the real message is the Bheda Vakya, in which it describes the difference between the Lord and everything else. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given the perfect synthesis that all the statements of Shastra are correct and none of them are to be discarded. When it is stated that he has no name, form, the Supreme has no name, form, qualities or activities, that means he has no name, form, qualities or activities as we understand them. His name, form, what we consider to be name, form, qualities and activities, that is on the mundane platform. But he has fully transcendental names, forms, qualities and activities. So he has no name, that's true. He doesn't have any mundane name, but he has unlimited transcendental names. He has no mundane form, but he has many transcendental forms which are non-different. Advaita machuti manadya mananta rupa madhyam purana purushan navayovanam cha. This is the Srimad Bhagavatam's reply to this undifferentiated monism. It's given in Brahma Samhita, which can be considered a summary. This fifth chapter of Brahma Samhita can be considered a summary of the principles given in Srimad Bhagavatam, that he is Advaita. That means there is nothing else but him. This Advaita, yes, we are also Advaita. We also accept Advaita in the sense there is nothing but him. Nothing exists without him or beyond him. Everything is within him. There is no other God. There is no other la illa awa illa. There is no other God but him. We call him Krishna. He himself calleth himself Krishna. Advaitam Achutam, Anadim Ananta Rupa. He has many unlimited forms, but at the same time he is Achuta. His forms are not subject to the frailties of material existence. Even though he enters within this material existence, he enters within the material cosmos, but he's not subjected to its laws. Etad ishanam ishasya prakriti sto pitad gunai. This is a most important understanding, that the godness of God, or here the term used is isha, the very intrinsic nature of his being the controller, what makes him the controller, is that even though he enters within the mundane prakriti, or the material nature, he remains situated within his own transcendental nature. This is something the Mayavadis cannot understand due to their poor fund of knowledge. Or those who say that he can have no form. Certain religious groups consider this idea most blasphemous, that Krishna is the Supreme, because he's a person who, from the mundane historical vantage, appeared within this world at a certain time. But the Supreme is not constricted by historical or by time. If we say that Krishna was present in this world and then for a certain time, he's not present now, that means he's a limited entity. Then how can he be supreme? They consider this a blasphemy. But Krishna is present. Sometimes he's manifested directly, and sometimes he's not. Or if you say he is limited because he's a person, he has a form, therefore he's limited. Just like we are in this, we see persons, we are all persons within material bodies. So our material body has certain limitations. We are now all here in Manama, in Bahrain. So not only are we're in a particular area of the city, we're in a particular building within that area, we're in a particular room within that area, and our form, this form, can only occupy that much space at any one particular time. In other words, just to give an example, Satya Harinam Das is sitting right there, don't mind me pointing at you, which means he's not also, his position is right there. So he's not even at the back of the room. What to speak, he's not in New York, or he's not on the moon. His form can only occupy that much space, that tiny little space within the universe at one moment. And then he may go somewhere else, but if he goes somewhere else, he won't be here. So in this way, form means limitation. So Krishna, we say he's the Supreme, and there is this form. But, and then people reject, well, how can he be Supreme? Because he's limited to being in one place at one time, if there's a form. But Krishna is in one place and in every place also, simultaneously. If he's supreme, he can be. So there are many mistaken suppositions of the eternal impersonal understanding. It's eternal, it's not created by Shankaracharya. It's always there because there are always people who are envious of the Supreme Lord and want to deny his personality. And they're very much against the idea of form. They actually become angry if you say that Krishna is supreme and this is his supreme form and everything is dependent upon him. They become angry. Why? Why? Their enviousness is manifested. But actually form is superior to amorphousness. Amorphousness means without form. This description of the creation of the universal form, there was just matter in an unmanifest state and it became manifest. It's just like you have a big pile of atta. So it's just a big pile of atta. But then when you shape, you make it into chapatis, that's better, isn't it? And the point of having atta is fulfilled by making chapatis. So the form is better than the non-form. Or sound. There are all kinds of sounds. But when you can take a musical instrument and make all kinds of horrible sounds if you don't know how to play it. But one who knows, they first of all, they put the musical instrument in tune, you tune it. If it's not tuned properly, you can't make proper sounds. And then they play music, and music is, it's very systematic, methodical. So just in an unstructured way, one can pick up a guitar or something and make a bunch of noise. But one who knows how to play it can play it in a systematic, ordered way. They give form to the sound in such a way that it is pleasing. Sound, just like now I'm speaking, I could also, from the same throat, I could make various sounds which have no meaning. But forming sounds in a particular way into words is meaningful. Non-form is meaningless. So to say that form is intrinsically inferior to non-form is a... what's that called? Sine non quo. It's not a very good philosophical basis. Well, you could say that, well, all sound, you say just like the sound, the form of sound comes from the unmanifest, unformed sound is the basis of all sound, either language or music. But that may be true, just like sounds. You see, now we're speaking in English, and there are so many other languages, and someone who is born, for instance, in Wales, and they grow up learning Welsh, then they'll have a whole difference, they're different sounds they have, which don't appear in English at all. Something like that. Oh, there's another example. In English, there's t, everything. But in Sanskrit, on this t, 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 So they're different sounds, different language system. But they all are different languages. The potential to speak all kinds of different languages are there in all different persons, because they all have the ability to, except dumb people, to pronounce sounds in various ways. So we can say that the source of all sound is amorphous, unformed. Well, in one sense that's true, but at the same time, it requires intelligence to extract and shape that sound meaningfully. So the intelligent platform is higher than the simply impersonal platform. The sounds in and of themselves have no ability to become shaped. It requires personality to give shape, meaningful shape, to that which is unshaped, whether it's making chapatis or making a sculpture or speaking a language or making music. So really the question is there, is which is higher, personality or non-personality? And the impersonalists conclude that non-personality is higher, but they have to be a personality to... they have to be a person to even make this philosophy or even discuss it. So again, their own philosophy is self-defeating. The air, which is a kind of nothingness, the air doesn't create philosophy. We don't discuss philosophy with non-persons. You say that, well, they say that there's no person, so we'll go discuss your philosophy with a stone. But we have to discuss with persons. So in so many ways it's self-defeating, the idea that personality is inferior to non-personality or impersonality. Anyway, this is a great discussion that's been going on since time immemorial and will go on, because certain people are envious of Krishna. Almost everyone in this material world. So it's necessary for devotees to very deeply understand these points. Yesterday I was saying, last night, about how that Indian culture, or Vedic culture, it's more favorable for Krishna consciousness in so many ways. But at the same time, modern Hindu culture is very much influenced by Shankaracharya and the neo-Advaitavad of Ramakrishna and Vivekananda, and most or almost all Hindus are very much steeped in a background of thinking all the gods are the same, everything comes from nothing, or impersonalism. And even the concept of bhakti is very strong in Hinduism, but underlying it is the idea that we do bhakti, we worship a god. Well, there are different concepts underlying it. One is the concept of pure devotion, that we worship Bhagavan simply out of love. That's not there. It's very, the bhakti means you worship this god, that god, any god, and you get something in return, material. And then underlying that is the idea that, well, all the gods are the same, And you can worship anything or anyone as God. That's why they have so many bogus. Anyone can declare themselves Bhagavan and no one objects. Because there's the idea that, well, everyone's Bhagavan and some are more developed than others. And the idea that there is no ultimate supreme. So we're doing bhakti, but it's bhakti is just a means. They give the example that you use the ladder and when you're finished you kick it away. You don't need it anymore. So unless we very deeply understand how much flawed is this Mayavad and Karmavad, which are the, you know, like brother and sister, bad brothers, and like Agasura and Bakasura, their sister is, who knows, Putana. So it's, you know, bad family. So this Mayavad and Smartavad, they're like brother and sister, bad family. So we shouldn't think that, well, you know, I'm doing bhakti, so, you know, that's all right. I'm chanting Hare Krishna, so it's okay. You just chant Hare Krishna, and then everything's okay. Well, that's true, but Shuddhanam, that is required. That is not possible to have Shuddhanam, or chanting in pure devotion, if we are contaminated by Smartavad, or Karmavad, and Mayavad. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada went to so much endeavor to again and again and again in his speaking and in his books to show the fallacies of these contaminating misunderstandings. So, this has been my theme in this visit to UAE and Bahrain. I've been speaking about this a lot. Don't just take it sentimentally. Don't presume that I'm advanced because, or I'm in bhakti because I have all these feelings. Those feelings can be, as Rupa Goswami has described, this ratyabhas. It can be not the real thing. Chaya Ratyabhas. It can simply be a reflection or a shadow of the real thing. We may think I have so much feeling, but unless our understanding of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead is clearly distinguished from Mayavad, which we have imbibed in this life and in previous lives, it's quite likely that our so-called bhakti or our feelings, it's not the real thing. Unless we feel disgust upon hearing Mayavad or hearing people praise these bogus avatars, then we're not really in bhakti at all. Just like Bhim, he always wanted to kill Duryodhana, Dushasana, because of their offenses. It wasn't just because Dushasana had dragged Draupadi and she's his wife, but because the offense to a Vaishnavi, because Bhim is a great devotee of Krishna. So, Bhima's anger, Hanuman's anger in burning Lanka, that is bhakti. And someone who says, it's all just smiling and being nice, and Mayavadis are also good, that's not bhakti. If we have any sympathy for Mayavad, then we're still a long way from the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada, who is Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatari, who delivered specifically the Western world from this impersonalism and voidism. So to cultivate dislike, not to cultivate, but that comes automatically. If one actually has affection for Krishna, then he must deeply resent this philosophy which attempts to make Krishna first of all an ordinary person and then an imperson, a non-entity altogether. It's extremely envious. So that dislike, that also should not be fanaticism, but based on philosophical understanding, which is why Srila Prabhupada again and again and again spoke about this and wrote about this, so that we can understand it. Siddhanta bolya chitte na koraha alash, eha hoite Krishna lage sudhiramanash. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami exhorts us, do not be lazy in the matter of understanding Siddhanta. For by doing so, one's mind becomes firmly attached to Krishna. Now there's a class of Prakriti Sahajyas, they think, well, this philosophy, it's not very important. We'll just do bhakti. That philosophy, that's for lesser people. That is their offensiveness, their imagined advancement, their offensiveness to the acharyas who have given us this philosophy, to Bhagavan himself, who is non-different from this philosophy, who is Srimad Bhagavatam, which presents this knowledge. So don't be lazy, don't think, well, I don't have to read these books. That's just reading books. That's, or if we read, we'll just read some. Nowadays they have these... well, I myself read that, like the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Just abridged version of Chaitanya Charitamrita. Reader's Digest edition. But I put philosophy in there also. And the idea is that we're supposed to... By reading that, we become enthusiastic to read the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita. Not that just, okay, I read the abridged version, that's enough. In my book on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, I put a warning in the beginning that there are certain devotees who, they're only interested in what they call nectar. They like the stories only. We like to hear the stories, but they're not much interested in hearing the philosophy. But we cannot understand Bhakti Siddhanta without understanding his Bhakti Siddhanta, his teachings. Simply by hearing the stories, that won't have much meaning. Or we won't understand or be able to enter the spirit of them unless we understand the teachings. Because we are contaminated by the misunderstanding Ishvaraham aham bhogi. I am the controller, I am the enjoyer. And another manifestation of this is avyaktam vyaktim apanam manyante maam, considering Krishna to be a manifestation of the non-manifest. So many devotees are asking, when will this book be ready? Well, it's almost there, because they're expecting to get lots of new stories about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. They will get many stories, no doubt. But it's not a matter simply of stories. That just like we like stories, so we'll listen to some stories. But what are the teachings that he has come to give? Leela, that is the ultimate. Especially Ras Leela, or especially Vraja Leela, and then especially Kaishal Leela, then especially Ras Leela, or even more the Surya Puja Leela at midday rather than midnight. So Leela is ultimate, but again, the foundation has to be there. I was saying that Shankaracharya's Mayavad, that is flawed. The very foundation is flawed. So if our bhakti is not on the strong foundation of clearly understanding who we are, what is our relationship with Krishna, then the prayojan, the ultimate goal, prem prayojan, will not be attained. Prayojan rests on some, first of all, there's sambandha gyan, understanding what is our relationship with Krishna in all details. On the basis of that, there is abhideya, devotional service in practice, from which comes prayojan, the ultimate goal of life, prem. But if we don't have clear understanding, then our practice of bhakti, even though we do all the things, we chant 16 rounds, we follow four regulated principles, if we don't have a clear understanding, then that means we have an unclear understanding. And that means that although apparently we're cultivating bhakti, we may be, this described in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, we will be cultivating the, instead of cultivating the bhakti lata, the plant of bhakti, we may be cultivating the karma lata, or jnana lata, or aparada lata. It may look the same, but it actually chokes the real plant of bhakti. So all these points have to be understood very carefully, very clearly. It is essential. It is not optional. It is required to understand Krishna as He is. Otherwise, when we think of Krishna, if we don't learn from the Amnai Parampara, from Shastra as delivered in Parampara, then when we're doing bhakti to Krishna, which Krishna will that be? Our understanding of Krishna comes from Amara Chitra Katha, from TV Mahabharata, from some Mayavadis, from our grandmother, all mixed up wrong ideas. That's why we have to hear. And even more so, maybe those coming from India, they have to hear again and again the Bhakti Vedanta Vani, Bhakti Siddhanta Vani, Gauravani, the message of the Acharyas and of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so that we can get all the nonsense in our heads straightened out and understand actually who Krishna is and what it means to serve Him and what it means to surrender to Him. Surrender is not just a word, it's analyzed. What is Sharanagati? There are six aspects of Sharanagati. Anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya parjanam, rakshishyatiti vishvaso guptritve varanam tatha. Atmanikshepa karpanye sharavidha sharanagati. So it's not just a word, but there has to be. Surrender means performing everything in a manner that is favorable for Krishna's service and rejecting everything which is unfavorable. Having full faith in Krishna as our protector and maintainer, and fully throwing ourselves at Krishna in all humility. So these are the components of Sharanagati. So like this, this is the science of bhakti, the complete science of bhakti has been presented by the Acharyas for our benefit. And we need to enter into that. Devotees are scientists. Jnanam teham savijnanam idam vakshami asheshatah. Lord Krishna tells Arjuna, I shall now describe to you this knowledge and science by understanding which there shall remain nothing further to be known. So this section of the Bhagavatam describing the creation of the universal form, that's also important. It's not that this is kind of technical and boring. Let's just go right up to Krishna stealing the gopis' clothes. That's more interesting. That's a dangerous mentality, which Shukdev Goswami didn't subscribe to. Parikshit Maharaj didn't subscribe to. Vyasadev didn't subscribe to. And Srila Prabhupada and none of our acharyas subscribed to. So, Hare Krishna. Is there any question, please? Please study Prabhupada's books. Take the time and trouble to study them. It shouldn't be that after 10 years of being initiated, you still have only read one or two cantos of Bhagavatam or less. It's an essential function for every devotee to study these books. After 10 years in Krishna consciousness, you should have read Prabhupada's books. At least once. Don't think it's not important. That's also another kind of offense, actually. Yeah.
Krishna is all what, sorry?
All
attractive.
Yeah.
And Krishna is also absolute, and there is no difference between his name and himself.
Yeah.
In that case, how possible one can become envious of Krishna?
Yes, why are you envious? You answer the question. You answer. Why are you envious of Krishna?
Is it because of our material conditional life?
No. The material conditional life is because of your envy, not round the other way. You don't know this basic point? Again and again people ask this question. You can't understand this basic point, which Prabhupada explained so many times. How long have you been you're initiated, I presume? How long since you've been initiated?
About 10 years.
10 years, you see. You don't understand this basic point? Again and again people are asking this question. It's our misuse of our own tiny independence. Because we are envious, we don't like to accept this, and therefore we're confused and we ask again and again and again the same point. It's because of our fault. It's not Krishna's fault. We have the opportunity to serve Krishna or to refuse to do so, deny to do so. We have misused that. We like to think, well, you know, I couldn't do anything wrong. It must be Krishna's fault, or the philosophy's wrong. It is our fault. Attractive means there is some sense of being attracted. One can, if Krishna was attractive simply like a magnet, if iron is attracted to a magnet, the iron doesn't think, its iron filings don't think, well, I think I'll go toward the magnet. They have no choice because they're unconscious entities. But we are conscious entities. So that attraction for Krishna is natural, but we have the choice to go toward Krishna or to deny that and think that why shouldn't Krishna be attracted to me? Why shouldn't I be the center? So we have the choice to be attracted or not attracted. If it were not for that, then there would be no question of love. Then we'd just be like figures in a cartoon. How many times? You've never heard this before? You never heard this?
Issues of independence, yes, but
why don't you speak in the mic? Yeah. You have the choice to do so or not.
Misuse of understanding her. But the question was, again, Maharaj, thank you for replying. But the same thing, that because Krishna is so powerful, and is absolute, that how a living entity can become envious?
It's the same stupid question again and again. Krishna is all powerful, but he doesn't force us. He gives us minute independence, which we can use or misuse. If Krishna forced us, then there'd be no question of love. I see devotees get confused, but it's only a manifestation of our envy of Krishna that we become confused on this point. We don't want to accept that it's our fault. Why doesn't Krishna force me to love him? It's an impossible proposition. That's called rape. When a man forces a woman to love, it's not love. It's rape. It's not enjoyable. So Krishna, if he forces us to serve him, he doesn't need our service, but he is looking for love, which means voluntary service.
Shankaracharya, when you are referring to this Mayavada philosophy, he advises a Brahmana that Bhajagovindam, Bhajagovindam, Sambhakti Sankara, everything he specifies. And the other side, when he is in trouble of fire, he prays in Nasma Karavala also. The other side, he says, that means he understands that they are supreme, they are deliverers and everything. And the other side, how can we say that we become equal, we become marginal, we almost the same bad man?
Do you know the answer? You're just answering, just asking.
How can he say it so? What
exactly? You don't know?
No.
You never heard this before? That Shankaracharya's Lord Shiva, who was deputed by Lord Narayan to spread the Mayavad philosophy, which is specifically to bewilder people in Kali Yuga who want to be bewildered. They want to go away from Krishna. So he gives that, because Lord Shiva has the job of overseeing Tamagun. So this tamasic philosophy, he propounds it in Kali Yuga. But at the same time, he is Lord Shiva, he is a devotee. So when he's doing his thankless task of preaching Mayavad, then he propounds Mayavad. And when he's being himself, then he says, Bhaja Govinda, you fools, Murha Mate, you're simply foolish intelligence, worship Govinda. Then again the question comes, why should Krishna give a philosophy that bewilders? Because we want it. Why should he give the material world at all? Why should there be any Maya? Because we want it. One time a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, why is Maya so strong? Prabhupada said, because your resolution is not strong. There's also a story in Mahabharata. Now it's a story. You can all wake up, you know. Put away the pillows. That in one king's court, the philosophical question was raised that why can't we get free from Maya? So many ministers, means brahmanas, they gave their idea. Why can't we get free from Maya? So they all spoke, except one older brahmana who was known to be very spiritually advanced. He hadn't said anything. He was just sitting. So everyone gave their theory why we can't get free from Maya. Then they all looked at him, as if to say, now it's your turn to speak. So he was just sitting there. Then all of a sudden he jumped up and ran to a pillar in the hall and embraced it and started calling out, "Let me go! Let me go! Let me go!" And they all thought he'd become crazy. So he did this for a few minutes and then he said, "This is why we can't get free from Maya. We're holding on to Maya and at the same time saying, 'Let me go.' We're not serious." It's our fault. We profess to want to be free from Maya. But do we really? That we have to ask ourselves. I'm going to finish now because my voice isn't doing too bad, but it is in pretty bad shape, so I'd better save it for Kuwait. It'd be pretty bad if I went there and didn't have any voice to speak with. That happened just 2 weeks ago. I spoke Sunday morning, I gave a class. Sunday midday, I gave a class. In the evening, there was a program with 1,000 people, but I lost my voice. So I have to be careful. I couldn't go to the program. So I'll finish here, and thank you very much for kindly receiving me. I very much appreciate your devotional mood. Thank you. Hare Krishna.